This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Brandon Adamson. We're going to start off by discussing his article, The Official Response to Trump's Remarks on the Alt-Left. Brandon, and it's great having you back on the show.
Hey, guys.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Sam Kevorkian.
Hey, thank you for having me co-host yet again and also do another show with Brandon.
Thanks, dude.
So this article, the context of it was you had this whole event in Charlottesville, and Trump had his statement, and this ended up pissing off a lot of liberals because he denounced the Antifa protesters too. But what ended up happening is he used the term, well, there's an alt-right, but there's also an alt-left, and they're pretty sinister as well. And this whole alt-left term has been popularized on Fox News, and then Trump finally used it. And from the standpoint of your blog, I'm sure it's gotten you massive traffic, but it's also led to a lot of confusion. How do you generally feel about this? Do you see it as a positive thing that it's getting you traffic, or does it piss you off that they're misinterpreting what you originally set out to do?
No, I don't care. I actually just love the absolute chaos that it has created and the confusion. That's like one of the reasons I wrote my response is I just wanted, it was just, the remarks were so ridiculous and just the media is so, really just so poor at research and, digging into actual facts and history and things that I just wanted to write a response that was just so outlandish that it was like, anyone who came to my site who was like, you know how they, I really hate these like political junkies, you know, that are just like, they rush to every news story and they just like really want the red meat. Like, what's this all about? And so I just wanted to make a response.
It's about all these like obscure cultural references.
Yeah. And if the thing is like, if a term of something, if the meaning is going to become so obscured by the press and so misinterpreted and so confused by all of these people, then why not just write a response that just kind of lays into all of that and it's in its own kind of way.
I think the site Forbes linked to your website.
Oh, I've been linked in many news websites. I was mentioned in The Week, which was actually one of the few articles which I give the reporter some credit. He actually did his research, and it was actually a good article, despite maybe some disagreements here and there. But he actually did his homework, unlike many of the other like Fox News and CNN, which have just been like even Wikipedia, just totally way off the mark and ridiculous. And it was also mentioned in a few foreign newspapers, like I think Der Spiegel, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, is a big, really big German newspaper, I believe. And the Huffington Post has been in there before. And there are a few others I notice I see in my link referrals, but I haven't really gone into all of them and seen what they're about.
Well, the one in The Week that you said was fair and accurate. How did they describe you?
Well, the headline was like the troubling origins of the term alt-left. And it kind of, it essentially gave all of the different ways that it kind of originated. And one of those, of course, included my site. I would say that the only area where I mainly disagreed with him is he said that it was originated with my site being people who were alt-right but more left-wing on economics. And I would disagree with that. I would say that it's people who were more left-wing on a wide variety of issues, as particularly rejecting a lot of the alt-right's traditionalism, like that it was very anti-traditionalist.
And the cultural issue, because there's this segment of people like the trad worker party. They're social conservatives, but they're like socially conservative, radical traditionalist socialist.
Right. You know, not just the Christians, but also like, you know, over the last few years, the alt-right has kind of morphed into this thing that's where they talk about like white Sharia and like, even though they use like a vaporwave aesthetics and whatnot, they still like, you know, want to go back to this kind of little house on the prairie society. And so it's weird because they mix that aesthetics with something that is totally incompatible with it, in my view.
And you even made the point that you think a lot of these protests are a waste of time and they accomplish very little.
You mean like the rallies and whatnot?
Like the Charlottesville thing.
Well, I think that, well, first I'll say that I don't go to these kinds of things. I think the main reason I don't go to them is because I'm afraid that like when I see the people that are there, it will make me like, not want to, engage in this kind of stuff just because they'll be so wacky that it's easier for us when we can just focus on the ideas, you know?
Yeah, event, the problem is it didn't have a coherent issue that it was protesting. The Confederate statues was kind of in the backdrop, but really it's just all these right-wing people finding an excuse to, like, basically go out there and put out their image.
Right, and the minute that the whole – I didn't like it because the whole idea of it was unite the right, and I don't think you know you're not going to be able to unite all of these people because they believe completely different things and want totally different goals. So there's no unity possible when you have all these people with widely different goals. And I think it's also these people are always constantly talking about ethno-nationalism and these kinds of things, but they don't. When it gets right down to it, they don't really think in those terms. Like they still think between like conservative and liberal and whatnot. They're not even in their own mindset that they claim to have. But I also will say though that I think that aside from like the you know the tragic girl that died, I think that the Charlottesville rally was a success in a sense that it provoked such an overreaction that it kind of forced a lot of people to get out of their comfort zone. So even when you see all of this censorship now, people finally have to kind of get off their ass and build like an alternative tech universe where before I think people were getting a little bit too comfortable with all their little blogs and their fun and stuff like that. And so now it actually forces people to be like, well, we're going to have to build our own payment system, but we're going to have to build our own social network. We're going to have to build our own video channel.
Well, the thing about that is, in a sense, you are right because there's this massive censorship and crackdown. My concern is it will end up like Gab as an alternative to YouTube. I mean, alternative to Twitter, where Gab just functions as an echo chamber for the far right.
Well, it could be that at first, but then what ends up happening is it becomes if entertainment and whatnot starts to get produced there that people want to see because they can't see anywhere else, then they will go to those sites. It's kind of like if you go to like Live Leak or something, if you want to just see something that's like really you can't really see anywhere else. So I think that it could become more and more people, and also it's been more eye opening because the censorship overreach has really gone toward almost everything. And so other people are starting to recognize that like, gee, like even if I don't have to be like a Nazi for these people to want to erase me or get rid of my blog or something. I just, you see, you have people getting, what was it like who had on ESPN was getting rid of that commentator because, his name was Robert Lee, even though he's Asian.
Oh, the Asian guy, yeah.
Yeah, that was like, hilarious. I mean, I was just talking to Robert about that. Like,
that's just
Dusio.
Surreal.
Yeah.
Like, so I think that's caused them to kind of lay their cards on the table. And what's been happening is unique because in the past, you know, if you had an offensive website or something, you know, your host might shut you down or whatever. But they've taken it a step further and actually gone after your domain provider. So even if you just like register a domain and host it in the Ukraine or something, then it's like they can go after just your domain. It doesn't matter where you host it. So remember, the old argument was, well, you know, these people, if you have offensive views, you don't have the right to be on social media. Go start your own website. Well, now you can't even register a domain. And if you're going to do that, and
yeah, the whole concept of free speech is bullshit. The idea, well, the kind of the basic concept that free speech is protection from a government, because basically, if you want to have a viable platform, you need a domain. Why do we even need to have to register through these two companies? It should just be you register a domain and then you own that domain.
Yeah, and also like Tor is not even allowing like hate groups to come on, like quote unquote hate groups to come on yet. Like they allow for like child porn and all types of sick shit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's odd, you know, these sites that were like that host like ISIS beheading videos and things like that. Like, oh, that's totally fine. But and you know, granted, the Daily Stormer is like they do go, I think, way over the top and some of the just really unnecessary things like that. They don't do themselves any favors. But a person can look at that though and say like, well, you know, my website isn't at that level, but you know, am I going to lose my domain just because I made fun of like you know, some feminist or something like that, or anyone really? It just depends who's in charge.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the whole sort of Google memo thing, that guy made some very milquetoast comments and he lost his job. It's getting to the point that even the most moderate sites that are even semi-politically incorrect will be shut down. I know Andy Nowicki and Colin Liddell's site got removed from Blogspot, which is, I think, owned by Google. And then VDare, which is fairly they're kind of on the moderate end of the alt-right, they got suspended from PayPal.
Yeah, and you know, those sites are like, in fact, the like Andy Nowicki's site and Colin Liddell, actually, their site was kind of known for being very anti Daily Stormer and kind of like always saying that those guys were too extreme. And then you see that their site got shut down too. So it's just kind of like the people censoring this stuff, they don't appreciate any kind of nuance or something. They just think that like everything is hate. And, like, I really hate that term because I've always said that, you know, philosophically, what's wrong with hate? Like most of this stuff isn't hate. Like just because like, it's like, if you don't want to go out on a date with someone, does that mean you hate them? Or does it mean you're just like not interested? You know, there's nothing, they just default everything to like, this is hate. And then the other part of that is, you know, you can't just get rid of hate or sadness or whatever. Like a healthy person is going to have a balanced range of emotions. Like
sure,
that's why
sure,
like
yeah.
humans have evolved for millions of years to have these different emotions that are useful in different situations. So the idea that that there's anything inherently wrong about hate, I just think is ridiculous. But I think that also they're miscategorizing basically any opinion they don't like as just being hateful.
Right.
Whereas, like I said, if you don't want to hang out with someone, right? If you don't want to live in a certain neighborhood, well, that's just preference. It just doesn't mean hate. It's like if you ask a girl like, hey, do you want to go out on a date? And she's like, well, no, thank you, I'm not interested. That doesn't mean she hates you. It just means, you know, no thanks.
Yeah, and it's also like the problem with the left and what makes them different from the right is that for the right, the cosmic struggle is between good and evil. For the left, the cosmic struggle is between love and hate. And that's, if you compare the two, the right actually has a more rational worldview because hate and love are both emotions that are part of the human experience. You know, if you haven't both loved and hated, then you're not a human being. While good and evil are a choice, you could choose to be good or evil, if that makes sense. You can't choose to love or hate, if that makes sense. Like, those of us who have ever been in a relationship, we probably hated and loved our wives and girlfriends simultaneously at the same time, or hated or loved them depending on our moods. Am I right?
Yeah, totally. And I would also add that the same people that say that you know, hate is wrong, like, there's plenty of people that they hate. You know,
yeah.
So the question isn't like whether or not the question isn't whether or not hate is bad. It's just whether or not it's justified in a given situation, and whether or not it's actually happening.
These individuals even are taking it to the level that if someone has the wrong kind of views, it's okay to hate them, or to a lot of them go as far as to even legitimize violence against them.
Yeah, totally. They cheer it on, in fact. Like
one example is, I was listening to a major talk show, and the talk show host was saying, like, Trump's equivalent between the two protesters, and that there was violence on the Antifa side. And what the protester said, sure, I mean, during World War II, our side committed violence too, but there was still a clear distinction between good and evil.
Yeah, and the problem with that is that the soldiers that fought in the U.S. in World War II would all be classified as Nazis today. They held beliefs that would have – they were fighting in a segregated military. You know, they were – so this idea that, like, oh, you know, we in England or the U.S., we fought these guys in World War II. Well, actually, like, the people that fought in World War II held beliefs which would make people today seem moderate.
Yeah, and a lot of the pro-war propaganda campaign, especially against Japan, was motivated by a racial component.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the cartoons from World War II, like the Japanese, I mean, it looks like something that you would see like on Stormfront or something like that. It's like that hardcore. And then also, you know, they rounded up the Japanese and put them in camps. Like, you know, people aren't even advocating that kind of stuff today, but that was just like, that was official policy.
Well, with the whole concept of calling your blog alt-left, I've thought about these different labels, but I kind of like how you confuse these closed-minded political hacks, because they have this idea of what the left is. And I'm talking about political hacks on both the right and
totally.
The left, because on one hand, you might get a Fox News type or even a Breitbart type that says, oh, those damn alt-left, left-wing lunatics, and they'll come to your blog. Then someone who's on the far left will come to your blog. Then they'll read this blog, and they'll just be – the whole mind will be blown away, because it will just break apart all their political conceptions. And that's why you put in all these kind of quirky cultural references, just to kind of confuse them.
Yeah, exactly. But they're also fairly fairly accurate, I think. But yeah, I mean, you remember this from a few years ago, right? Where we just kind of at a certain point, we realized we didn't really fit into the alt-right. And so we didn't have anywhere to go. Like, people like Anatoly Karlin and some of these others, like Robert Lindsay, we didn't have, just being honest with yourself, realize, like, yeah, I can't really pretend to be on board with all of this stuff. So, I mean, that was kind of why I started the blog. It actually was a reaction to a lot of my experiences being in some of these reactionary circles. And I found out that I did have a much more left-wing worldview of history, especially in terms of, like, the U.S. Foreign policy and social policy and things like that.
You made one comment in here is you said that Trump's comments are a slap in the face to anyone who believes that the less aggro elements of the Antifa and the alt-right should combine forces to get single-payer health care passed and a plan for student debt relief. I think that's an interesting point because I would really like to see a sort of the dissident right and the dissident left work together to actually work for issues where they find common ground. But these groups, you get these crazy people like the crazy Antifa and some crazy right-wing types as well, like focusing all their energy attacking one another rather than talking about these serious crucial issues.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, like they hate each other so much, it's almost impossible. But I thought that for a time, you know, with the right leadership, you know, these groups, you look at them fighting, and they almost like they look so much alike. Like when I watch these fights, like I can't even tell like the who's who or the what's what. Like when you see the video footage, like they almost look so much alike. But to me, it's like, I just watch this and I'm just like, you know, why are these guys, why are they protesting each other? Like, you could almost envision a scenario where the cops get out of control and start attacking and they ended up on the same side or something somehow. But I would say that there could have been a way for that, especially when you had people from the alt-right actually protesting Trump's war and whatnot. There, people are so caught up in thinking that everyone in the alt-right is some kind of like normie Trump supporter and whatnot. They kind of forget that there are a lot of people that are really skeptical of Trump and have actually pushed back on him on a lot of these issues.
Like, yeah, even someone like Richard Spencer, he's came out against all the wars. He supported nationalized healthcare. But I can guarantee like 90% of the Antifa assume he's just another like a racist version of a Republican. And those types definitely do exist. They're basically like the Republican Party, just racist.
Right, I would say that's probably like maybe half of the alt-right are just kind of like these people who are just like, they were just Tea Party Republicans or Libertarians, and they've kind of like just added some race realism and edgy memes. But there are also other components of the more intellectual side that are really not, that are kind of more, want like a more European style of socialism and are a little bit more more pro environment and anti corporate and things like that. Those were the things that I initially kind of liked about the alt right as it existed a few years ago. But as like I said, when even though I have a lot of left wing views, if you have the if you take a look at the left now, it's almost like totally consumed by the number one issue they prioritize is like hatred for whites and like white men, and even not even just white men, but even like someone who's like kind of white, you know, like they're just really almost just like anyone.
Do you wonder, like, I mean, do you think that Asian men would be next on the list after white men because they are like socially successful, rich people who succeed at the meritocracy and don't rely on handouts?
Well, I think that it's just really just anyone. I think anyone who perhaps Asians, but also you see in certain instances, like even like a light-skinned black person, like won't be accepted. You know what I mean? Like you see this like pretty often, even in like schools and whatnot, they will come after someone like that, or they will attack someone like online or something for their white privilege or whatever, and it'll be someone who's like, you know, really only like maybe barely could be considered white, but they're just like, they just run with it. Anyway, like Zimmerman, remember? Like Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. So it's like they do that. And so I think that it's just, but it's totally consumed by that, because a lot of the left wing like ideas and things I like when I watch the older people, because I'm old enough to remember when it wasn't like really all about this stuff. So even when you had people like Eugene McCarthy, or even I think even like Jimmy Carter in the 70s was like nothing like he is now. In the 80s, maybe up until about Dukakis, like if you watched any of this stuff, I remember in 2004, I considered supporting John Edwards for president back then, because this stuff was like not so prominent.
Do you think John Edwards would be nominated for the Democrat candidacy for president today?
No, I mean, that was before all of his scandals and whatnot really came to light. But
yeah, assuming that like he didn't have any scandals or anything like that.
No, absolutely not. I don't think that he would really have I don't think he would really have much of a chance. But you never really know, because I actually thought that Jim Webb would have been a good candidate, but he didn't get any traction, and he was the closest thing to like a John Edwards.
Yeah, I would actually prefer Jim Webb over Trump, but he was totally marginal.
Yeah,
I mean, like, Trump is just like, I would have preferred Jim Webb. He's just more coherent. Trump just doesn't have any real coherence. Like, he's totally like unpredictable. It's almost like he'll really just say anything. It's just he contradicts himself all the time, and he enacts policies that are like the exact opposite of what he was just like yelling about. You know, so he just doesn't really make much sense, and people will latch on to something like, he really said it right there, but it's just like, it's just totally empty, because like the next day he'll do something completely different. So I don't know why people like are still hanging on to these words and whatnot. And back in the campaign, he did articulate a lot of things that I agreed with. I did support him, but you see that now that he's just like all over the map. And back then we didn't really have any other choices, but now he's the president. So there's no reason to like pretend or something that we have to support this guy. 'Cause it's not like in the campaign where it's just him and Hillary, you know, and that time is over.
So you would basically say that if putting aside the issue of immigration and some of the SJW stuff, you're much closer politically to Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump.
I think that Sanders' problem though was always I could never support him, because he had no real backbone, I don't think, and also he was just very easily bullied into switching positions, because he used to be kind of anti-open borders, and then when people got on him about it,
he reversed in two seconds.
Yeah,
there was an interview where Bernie Sanders said that open borders was a Koch brothers conspiracy, which is actually totally true.
Yeah, it is. But the minute that someone was like accused him of something, he was just like he backed down immediately. It was kind of like those Black Lives Matter protesters, you know, went on stage during one of his rallies. He's just like two women and like harassed him, and he just was like, I don't know what he did, but his response was basically pathetic. Like, he should have told them to like you fuck off and get off the stage or something. Like, I'm talking, you know. But he was like, just the most pathetic response, and it was just like, okay, obviously this person has absolutely no interest in standing up for these people. And just on Twitter, like, he does like a lot of the most really like cheesy virtue signaling. It's just like, I don't know, it just makes me want to barf. But someone like Jim Webb actually seemed like he had some balls. But I think really just all of these politicians are, the choices are so horrible that it's just like, when I say like, you support this person or you vote for, it's really like, it doesn't really mean a whole lot because they're basically all useless as soon as they get into office.
What do you think about student debt relief and family formation from a alt-right perspective? Kind of weird that, but well, yeah, because you're alt-left, you're not alt-right, but or maybe alt-left is an umbrella under that.
What do I think about student debt relief?
Yeah, and family formation from an alt-right perspective.
I don't know whether or not that's really the case. I think that it has a lot to do just with the issue of space and money in general. I think that people are going to have larger families if they have more money and more space to have them. If you're paying like $2,000 a month for like a studio apartment in the city, like you're not going to be having kids. It just wouldn't make sense. So I don't know, but I don't really care. I think that the population is already way too high. So like, I'm all for, it being lowered. I just think that, people need to get to an area where they have space and can basically separate from all of these hordes of people. But in terms of student debt relief, I think that a big problem is that these student loans, it's too easy to get these student loans, and that allows the colleges to charge higher tuition. And then it also, what also happens is that it's too easy for these colleges to import wealthy students from other countries. And so that also brings the tuition up. If you bring these people over from Saudi Arabia and the Middle East to go to school here, that can really just pay anything. And I think that there's too much emphasis on basically turning colleges into these industries. Like I talk about like the college football industrial complex. So it's almost
mentioned that in your article. You said that you were kind of joking the Antifa and alt-right should combine dual energies in dismantling the college football industrial complex.
Yeah, because I think that I watch a lot of these like older college games, and I remember them when I was a kid, and now it's like such a huge industry. Every year, like the season gets longer. Now they have like playoffs and like they fight about like who's number one in the national championship. And it used to be that like they would have these bowl games and it was just kids. And the rivalries would be like, if you were from the Pac-10, the winner would play the winner from the Big Ten in the Rose Bowl. And that was it. And it wasn't just all about like finding the perfect national championship formula, you know, where you have playoffs and you make sure it's all about being number one in the nation. It was more about these kind of interconference rivalries and things like that. And I remember when I was a kid, and I actually wrote about this many years ago, the bowl games, they used to be named after like these fruits and commodities and things like, you know, like the Gator Bowl and the Blue Bonnet Bowl and all this kind of stuff. And then over time, as they're more and more, the names started changing, like, you know, the Little Caesars Pizza Bowl and like the Blockbuster Video Bowl and things like that. And it was just kind of, the whole thing just became so industrialized that I think I think it took away from kind of the aesthetic component of it. It was just kind of also made it, just kind of gross, but also it made it into these things where like, we forgot these are just supposed to be kids going to school. And this is just like an activity for them.
There was a question that I want to ask about related to going back to the college issue about specifically about spinsterism among women, because there's a cultural thing where women are encouraged to pursue careers and education, even if, like, in the end, they end up working, like, in my opinion, pretty useless jobs that don't contribute much to the overall economy. What do you think about that?
No, I think that, like, now what happens is that you have a lot of the nature of a lot of work has changed. So I think that in many of those instances, women are more suitable for the kinds of work that exist today. Because if you were, people will say, like, oh, well, you know, traditionally these women didn't work in these in jobs or whatever. But in the 1800s, like, when people were like building railroads and whatnot, yeah, that probably wasn't suitable. But when you're talking about maybe either like coding an app or something, or working in, social media or something like that, like anything which requires a good deal of organizational skills and things like that. Those are, like, I don't see any reason why women wouldn't be better, like office manager and things like that. Like, women are perfectly suitable for those roles, because we're not talking about, like, logging and things like that. Laying brick. But I will also say that even though many women engage in these kinds of jobs, that a lot of those kinds of women are the ones that people like to criticize, but those kinds of women are actually probably some of the healthiest and like best to be in an actual relationship with, ironically, whereas a lot of the ones who maybe don't want to work and are, like, really lazy and irresponsible, like, also make bad people to actually be in relationships with. Also, even though they may be like, they may want to stay at home and do things like that, like, I don't know. I prefer a woman who is intelligent and just really just has her shit together. And I think that those kinds of women can really juggle it all when they want to.
Right. But what I mean is that it seems like, from my perspective at least, that a lot of corporate offices have too many employees altogether. I don't know. I'm not an expert on, like, how to run a company, but I would, I've talked to my friend who works at a small company, and, like, they run, and there aren't that many women around, so they have a leaner, meaner operation where you can't fool around, and I feel that, like, at a lot of, like, the bigger companies, there is, like, where they mostly hire a lot of women, a lot of the companies I've worked at, and it just seems like a big hoopla. It's kind of like a extension of high school in a way. That's sort of like my, like, subjective perspective, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think in my experience, having worked at a lot of different social media and tech related companies, my experience has been that the women who work there were usually better workers and more passionate, whereas a lot of the guys that I worked with were just either just outright doofs or just, like, super lazy. I don't know. I think there's something about that. I think that from what I've seen, like, a lot of women are actually more like heavily invested in the work that they do, and they take more pride in it. Like, but that could also just be also like a millennial thing because I'm older. I'm like Generation X. So I'm very cynical when I go into a job situation and I just am like, you know, when they, you know, talk about the brand and the vision for the kind of living the brand and things like that. To me, that's just like all complete bullshit. And like,
well,
but a lot of these
people buy into it. Well, I don't buy into it at all. And I'm a millennial. I'm 31 years old, like near like the later end of the millennial. I'm an older millennial. I think, in my opinion, like they depend, like the current corporate culture is that like you can't just show up and do your job. You also have to love your job and love the company and love interacting with the people. And I just think that whole thing is bullshit. Like, why can't...
It's a scam to really... And, you know, that actually, to bring things back, that actually, in my opinion, I think that this ties in also to the censorship because one thing that's changed in the last 10 or 15 years is that, and this is why censorship is actually a workers' rights issue. And I wish that people in Antifa and these other groups would see that because it's really, they're too confused by the fact of it's like, it's just something they can use to take out their enemies, but it's really a workers' rights issue because what these corporations really want is they want to be able to control like how you look and what you do outside of work because
yeah,
they can always
exactly.
claim
exactly.
They claims that
during the Google, during the Google memo thing, that guy who got fired, one of his comments and his response was that Google wants, they basically have a corporate culture where they demand consensus. That was one of the things he points out.
Well, yeah, and,
yeah,
they use this argument that, you know, what you do outside of work can reflect poorly on our brand if you're associated with us. So
yeah,
basically that can extend to so many things. Like at my old job where I work, they had a specific clause where it said that you in the handbook that you could not engage in any visible political activities outside of work. Like it didn't even say like any kind. It was just like it would reflect poorly on our brand. And there are also some of these different tech companies that will say that you're not allowed to wear your t-shirt with the company name on it. You're not allowed to wear that outside of work.
Right. Well,
because you could be. Go ahead.
Yeah. One thing I've noticed is that like you have more freedom to wear what you want to work, as opposed to like in the 80s, you have to wear a suit and a tie to work, you know. So I think that's the one thing that has like changed for the better. Like now you could go to work with long hair and tattoos or piercings and they'd be totally cool with it. Like that's the only part that where they've become more liberal, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but I think it's also kind of like a bribe in a way. It's kind of like how these places they have all these free snacks and drinks and things like that when you go to work. Now these tech companies, it's just like they're going to like feed you and make you fat. I think it's just like
I've noticed that. Yeah, it's so true. I've noticed that every tech company I've worked at, and it's also this.
And they will give you like these snacks and these like these stupid like perks instead of like paying you more money. It's like, well, geez, instead of like giving me snacks every week or something, how about just give me like an extra $10 a week in my paycheck? Like, I don't need these fucking pretzels. It's something where somebody somewhere did a study that was like, you know, we can get away with paying a lower salary if we just promote the idea that like we have a really fun culture here, you know, and that's what they do.
Just want to continue on that, how like it's basically now like your company has to like you have to be friends with your coworkers. Like, you know, in the old days, like when my mom was going to work, we just like people were just, you know, working, doing their job, and going home. Yet, if you act that way in the modern work environment, you'll rub a lot of people the wrong way. Like, they would think, like, you're anti-social or something.
Yeah, exactly. Or you can, you know, they will say, like, you're not a good culture fit or something like that. And it's, they will, yeah. My old job would always have all kinds of these, like, these team building events and whatnot. And it's like, well, you know, I'm sorry, but I don't want to go to this stuff outside of work. Like, when I clock out, like, that's it. I check out. I'm out of this.
Yeah. My
mind is out of this.
I'm the exact same way. And it's also like all this talk about, like, there is all this bullshit about company culture at all of these, like, in all of these magazines and articles on the internet. And it's just, yeah, the whole thing is, like, complete BS. And, like, to continue on that point, I think it's better if, like, why don't they, like, just, in my ideal world, like, the way I would change it is that I would have people work only 5 hours a day, but pay them more per hour, if that makes sense. 5 or 6 hours a day.
What I would do is I would make it basically a law that says the company cannot control anything you do outside of work, like, unless you have, like, a felony or something like that. The company can't control anything about that. I think that would work out better for people, and also somewhat better for the companies, because if somebody boycotts your brand or something because somebody that you hired participated in some kind of protest, then you can say, well, by law, we can't fire him. So, you know, don't boycott us, because there's really nothing we can do.
Right.
You know, so it gives them kind of an out.
Yeah. Also, the reason why I say 5 hours, because if you try to work a full 8 hour day, especially in the type of work I do with, involves a lot of problem solving, most of the time I just end up checking my email or diddling around, going on the internet and stuff.
Also, right. Your point is it kind of makes it so you don't have the free time to do something creative or intellectual.
Yeah, exactly. Or, like, just creative or intellectual, or doing hobbies, or simply hanging out with your friends or your family.
Yeah, and at a certain point, if you work, if they work you too many hours, like, they're not getting more out of you because you're just screwing around at that point. If you realize that you're stuck there for your entire day, then you're going to try to get other things done that you would be getting done outside of work, because you just have to squeeze them in somehow. So you squeeze them in while you're at work, like, screwing around on the internet or, like, paying bills, things like that.
So you did write a review of the interview I did with Zoltan Isvan on the basic income. And I think you were on the show where we interviewed him for running for president, and I plan on voting for him. I think it's important just to kind of get the issue out there. But your point was that you disagree with his plan of monetizing federal land. So you're saying you'd much rather, if we were to have a basic income, you'd much rather see it being done by taxing billionaires than developing California's open space.
Well, I just think that particular scheme is just not going to work, because I mean, just for the reasons that I laid out. But I think also one of the biggest reasons is that you're expecting that California is somehow going to be able to first of all, I don't think it's a good idea to be developing very much more land in California. I think that what's left is beautiful and should basically just be left alone. Like, we don't need it to be developed into these, like, stupid social media companies and apartments in the middle, or whatever would be developed there, who knows. But I think that also you're not dealing with a static situation where, yeah, maybe if you develop some of this land, then you could make money and divide it among the people. But what happens is, if you're developing this, then there's a constant flow of more and more people to California, and more people, the population is growing. So,
well, didn't I address that in the interview?
Well, I mean, perhaps you did, but I think that what I'm getting at, though, is if you say, well, you know, we're just going to limit it who gets the income to people who have lived here for a certain period of time.
Yeah, I did ask him that. Should there be a residency restriction? And I think, yeah, he did say that's reasonable.
But the problem is, though, is you're asking California to have this residency restriction for people living there, citizens living there, when they're not even willing to deny these types of social programs to, like, illegal aliens and people who aren't even citizens of the United States yet. Like, you're expecting these people to enforce that on like people who are just simply like residents that haven't lived there very long or something like that. Like, there's no way they're going to do that. And in order to do it, you would have to require almost like a draconian kind of like border control to keep people out of California. If everyone there gets this kind of basic income or whatever, I mean, it would require like something almost like North Korea level, the policing.
Yeah, I'm kind of critical and skeptical of the whole basic income thing altogether. And the reason why is because I think a lot of the cultural problems that we have is largely due to socialism. Like, for example, especially when related to feminism with, you know, with student loans and, you know, in the old days, women had to decide, like men and women in general had to decide quickly what they wanted to do with their life. I mean, most women would have chosen to get married, and most men would have had a job by the time they're 25. They would have been able to start a family, and most women would have gotten married at 18, or if they couldn't get married, they would have found like a job at some company, like as a secretary or something, and maybe, I don't know, it's sort of like, and it's also the whole maternity leave thing, it's another form of socialism. And if you look at the Black community, is like with the welfare, has the whole war on poverty has pretty much destroyed the Black community, has destroyed Black families. And because women now are taken care of by the state, so they don't have to try to find a good man that has to provide for them. They just have, you know, they're free to like chase after like the drug dealer or gangbanger or whatever, because like the state will take care of like their illegitimate children, you know.
Well, how much of that is just time preference, though? Like, I think you see those same problems in Black communities like everywhere in the world, like even regardless of the kind of government that is having. Even if you go to somewhere like Somalia or Haiti or what, some place that isn't known for that. I think that my problem with the universal basic income, like as it is often proposed, is that I think that in order for any kind of like socialism to work, I think that you can't just give people money for doing nothing. You have, even if you're just giving them like make work, even if you had this universal basic income in, you paid people just to exercise or something, like, you know what I mean? Just to like pay them to get in shape or something. I don't think that it can be a situation like welfare where you go down and just pick up a check or something like that. And every month and just like go down and buy Cheetos or whatever. I think that for any kind of socialism to work, it has to work in the sense that people are all contributing something. They're working, even if you have to go out and pick up trash,
right,
something like that. And anything which is actually makes you feel that you have to actually be participating and not just receiving.
So
that's the only way. That's why socialism actually works decently in places like Japan and Norway and things before they started importing millions of people, is because if you meet people from those countries, like they have an understanding that, yeah, they're getting free healthcare, but that they're part of something bigger than themselves, so they're not going to like abuse it and just go to the doctor every day. They realize that they should be they're part of it, and they have to be contributed, putting something in.
Yeah, but I don't think it would work the same way in America, because Americans don't have, for the most part, don't have a common sense of identity. You know, having a sense of an American identity is kind of like a Hicks Southern thing. Like, most minorities and non-whites in L.A. and California in general don't really have a sense of an American identity. And it's also, I think that, to continue on that point, I think most people, if they're given a universal basic income, most Americans would just waste all their time looking at pornography and, like, you know, just not doing things that are productive, or like they're just.
That's why you have to do it like in Roosevelt, like a public works program and things like that. Like, you have to. You can't just give people money for doing nothing. But I actually agree with you, but I don't ever think in terms of like America. I think that America as a country is really something non-existent in most of my thought. I think in terms of small scale tribalism, I think that the U.S. is like way too big and has way too many people. And I think that, At one time, maybe there was a distinct American identity, maybe in the mid 20th century, but I think that they've ruined that by importing so many different kinds of people to where it's totally disintegrated into these into ethnic conflict and all of these other regional things. I support really just small scale states and small scale tribalism. I think that anytime you get too many people, whether it be in a nation or even in just in an arena, which you see is really just a devaluing of human life and just less empathy and less cooperation. You know, and so it's kind of like, I like the idea of small state, like a state like Vermont should be like its own country. You know, the South should really be kind of its own country, maybe even just a few states in the South. The Northwest should be its own. California should be its own country. Maybe even only like one third of California should be its own country.
Even like LA or the San Francisco Bay Area could be broken up into like smaller city states.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think in terms of America as a whole. Like I think in terms of like a post America, whenever I make political recommendations, I think America is basically really unsalvageable as it is. It's just, I mean, it'll probably still go along maybe for another, for a long time. But in terms of like what is actually like practical for like a solution, I don't really see a way forward.
Back on your alt-left article, you talk about this concept called the orange pill, which is obviously a joke, but what are you kind of getting at for the alt-left?
Well, it's not even so much like just a just really an alt-left thing. It's just kind of it's kind of abstract in the sense that when you look at all of these these groups that are fighting. It's kind of, I think I wrote like, yeah, instead of going to like a rally and getting maced by some strange looking subhumans or whatever, you just kind of like, you know, head on down to the mall and order an Orange Julius and just think about things. And I think that was part of what I talked about earlier when I was saying like about getting into like new suburbanism was kind of like where you more of like looking to getting back to the idea of escape, you know, and building some kind of a community and these city states. And that was the kind of stuff that initially attracted me to the neo-reactionary community, I think, is like was the idea of exit. So that's basically something along the lines of what I was talking about.
That's kind of what your video, you did a video on self-checkout called The New Suburbanists, but I really don't see how it's kind of dramatically different than New Urbanism. New Urbanism is sort of trying to get the best attributes of cities and suburbs, like taking these decaying suburbs and retrofitting them into walkable communities. How is New Suburbanism dramatically different?
I mean, New Urbanism deals a lot, I think, a lot more with reclaiming like the urban centers and for people who like living in city, getting people to want to live like in downtown places and high rises and things like that. And I think that with New Suburbanism, it's kind of this recognition that I had several years ago where when you go to like these malls now, you start to see that a lot of the big corporations have abandoned many of these malls. And so when I went to the food court, I noticed that a lot of the restaurants, they were like locally owned like restaurants. And so you have more and more of these people, because a lot of the new urbanism stuff has been kind of like big corporations are cashing in on this stuff and putting in these gentrified areas. They're kind of like, becoming more corporatized, you know, like even like tech companies are opening up in there. And then you have these you know, chains like what do you like Chipotle and things opening up in these kind of like hipster downtown, you know, it's more of like along the lines of because there was new urbanism and people started, and a lot of these suburbs have now died out in the same way that like the cities had died out in the 80s. Remember, they've been kind of abandoned and the buildings were falling apart and worthless. You see that now in these suburbs. And I noticed that they're starting to be cheap enough where people are starting to move in, and instead of opening up their, you know, their cereal bar or their coffee shop or whatever, like instead of opening up that like downtown, they're starting to open up those kinds of places in the suburbs where there used to be like a McDonald's or something like that.
So you're kind of talking about making them into desirable places to live, dramatically changing the aesthetics, or just kind of keeping it as a suburban?
Well, keeping it in kind of like, you know, something is only really becomes a, good after people start to recognize what they lost. So it's like it was fashionable several years ago to be like, you know, the suburbs are so cookie cutter and gross and you know, all of these strip malls and whatnot, and so, but now you see all of these people having starting to realize that a lot of this like 70s and 80s malls and what really did have like a distinct kind of look to them that people kind of are just now starting to appreciate. So that's why you see so many of these videos on dead malls where you kind of, they're looked at in a way that they were really never looked at before, in the same way that 10 or 15 years ago, a lot of those urban buildings were suddenly appreciated and mid-century modern and things like that. So to me, New suburbanism is kind of another phase in that, where we say like, hey, you know, maybe let's not tear all this stuff down. Maybe there's some cool stuff here that we can that can be repurposed. You know, maybe these old malls, we could turn them into like lavish, like condo places that are kind of mixed living, like we've talked about on previous shows where.
Oh, kind of like how you said your ideal utopia would be like the film Logan's Run, and Logan's Run kind of has the feeling of like a 70s mall.
Well, it was shot in a 70s mall in Dallas.
Oh, yeah. So definitely.
So, but I think that that's just part of it, and just how you see these old industrial buildings in the city that have been repurposed into apartments, you know, because they have like the brick wall aesthetic and these historical areas. I think that you're starting to see more of an appreciation for this kind of weird 1980s suburbia and like neon kind of aesthetic that people really never appreciated at the time, but it's, or never thought anyone would appreciate, maybe.
I'm not sure. In L.A., most of those old 80s malls, except for the, well, they have all the strip malls, but the big ones, like the Beverly Center and Westside Pavilion, have been renovated, so they're really bland now.
Yeah, they have. But every time one gets renovated or demolished, it just, it makes the ones that are left that much more appealing and better, because it's like they're suddenly more unique, you know. I think because people have much more nostalgia for like the Galleria, which was in Sherman Oaks.
Brandon Adamson, is there anything else you'd like to add about the whole reaction to the alt-left or the future direction of the alt-left scene?
Well, the future of it is, of course, is going to be chaos, I guess, which is what it always was. It's like Christian Slater said in Heathers. He said, like, it was great. Chaos was great. You say, like, chaos is what killed the dinosaurs or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that, I'm just going to continue writing about these kinds of topics, and it doesn't really have to, mean anything. You know, like I said, those of us who have been affiliated with the alt-left, as it was in 2015 or years ago, I think that we were always people who were politically homeless, or didn't really feel like we fit in, don't even fit in with like these annoying centrists that are like, oh, I hate both sides or whatever. Like, I don't even fit in with those people. I don't like them either, you know? So, and basically, so it's just going to be chaos. It is what it is. And apparently, according, if the media is any indicator, the alt-left really is, it's whatever you want it to be.
We are at the end of the show. I'd like to thank Brandon Adamson for being on, and also thank Sam Kevorkian.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.